Did y'all see Donna Bohannon? Just popped in to say hi. Did y'all see her? You all may not remember her. Yeah, they used to be in our class, she and her husband, Bo. They moved up to Arkansas, I believe it was.
You all might have, possibly, but I don't think you might have, too. I don't know.
Yeah. Bo moved on up to heaven, so he's not around. That was her son that was with her this morning. But they were in the class for quite some time.
I've known 73 years.
73 years. Where did you first meet them, Bob? As kids?
High school.
In high school.
She was head majorette.
That's adorable.
In fact, some of the majorettes now live at the old folks' home where I do.
Is that right?
Woodrow Wilson.
Okay.
What did you know, Patsy Kramer and George?
Yeah.
They went to Woodrow.
Yeah.
Met. They were high school classmates.
Did you know Francie L. Weber?
No, please. I graduated in 1950. I'm old.
Well, no, but she was. Yeah, she would be that same vintage.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Some people go back a long time together, don't they? I'm glad I don't know anybody that knew me back in those years. They're all somewhere else, I'm glad to say. All right, we're in the book of Daniel. And we mentioned last week that this book is the most inclusive, broadest presentation of biblical eschatology that we have in any one book anywhere. It only covers 2,600 years of biblical eschatology. And still counting. The 2,600 isn't up because it ends when the Lord comes back. And so what we get in this book is a panorama of everything God is going to do from the time of this book, which is around 600 BC, all the way down to the start of the millennial kingdom, which hasn't even happened yet. So we're not even there yet, but we're about 2,600 years into the saga. And the way all of that information is going to be conveyed to us is through a series of dreams and visions. This is a book for dreamers and visionaries. That's the way God is going to communicate to us. There's going to be three visions that have to do with Gentile eschatology, perhaps a little more than the others. And three more that has to do with Israel's future and eschatology. So it's a book of dreams and visions, and there's six of them. And in those six, God is going to reveal to us what he's going to do in the affairs of men from 600 BC down to at least 7 years after we're out of here. Because it goes down to when the Lord comes back and sets up his millennial kingdom, which will take at least 7 years after the rapture. And those visions, here's a little more detail of them. Nebuchadnezzar is going to have a vision in chapter 2. Then there's chapter 7 is the kind of the picture of future world history. Then we'll have a vision of a ram and he-goat. And then the most interesting prophecy of the Daniel's 70th week, which is the definition of the tribulation period, by the way. And then we'll have the vision of the glory of God, and then we'll have some Old Testament history that runs on down here toward the end of it. And so that's how this information is going to come together for us, as I say, through visions and dreams. Where'd everybody go?
I got it.
Okay. Yeah, flip that switch up and we'll actually be able to see our Bibles here. Okay. Now last week in chapter 1 we saw how the book setting began. Daniel gets carried down to Babylon by this dastardly Nebuchadnezzar guy, head of the Babylonian Empire. And he went through a training program that prepared him for service in Nebuchadnezzar's court. And part of his preparation in verse 17 of chapter 1 said, Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. So he's going to be the vehicle through whom these visions and dreams are interpreted and made known to Nebuchadnezzar and consequently us. So the principle in that passage we should not skip over, and that is the principle that if God has a role for us, a job for us, he doesn't give us the job until he's prepared us to do it. If we have an assignment from God, we will have preparation by him for that assignment. And in Daniel's case, it took place in that three-year Rhodes Scholarship-like thing he went through. And during that time of learning the Babylonian ways and how to speak their language and their religions and all that nonsense, God equipped him with the ability to interpret and understand dreams. So Daniel is at the ready. When these visions start, he's already equipped and ready to go, which is good because he needs to be, as we will see. So let's look at chapter 2 and see if we can get some of these visions cranked up and going here. Daniel chapter 2, verse 1. Now, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, remember, he just kind of cranking up down there, so this is a pretty early on in Daniel's experience with him. He had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Now, this particular dream that's going to be mentioned first here is not the result of eating some cold pizza before going to bed. Oh, there's Haley with her magic camera.
Y'all keep doing your thing.
Okay. This is the camera that makes us all look 20 years younger, so be sure and try to get in this picture if you can. At any rate, he has this dream, and this one really bothers him. Now, everybody has dreams from time to time, right? Not that big of a deal. Usually they don't kind of wear on you or bother you or nag at you or something of that sort. And this one does. This one really bothers Nebuchadnezzar, unlike most dreams. So he's got this whole social substructure of wise men at his disposal who are supposedly able to interpret dreams and all that kind of stuff. So he calls them together. He gave orders to call in, and there's at least four categories of them here, magicians, conjurers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans, to tell the king his dream. So he's got all of these guys at his disposal. So he says, round up all these guys and get them in here. And so they did. They came and stood before the king. So unlike most guys, he's got people at his disposal to try to explain this dream to him. Now, he's no dummy. The way he goes about this is that he tells his guys, verse 3, I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. Okay, that's cool. So the guys say to him, well, tell us the dream and we'll tell you what it means. We can blow smoke at you just as much as we can anybody. And he knows that. So the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever, tell the dream to your servants and we will declare the interpretation. Of course we will. Of course we might need a few minutes together apart from you so we can get our story all together. And he knows that's a possibility. He knows that they can fake it, not really know what he's talking about, but just come up with something. So tell us what you dream, Nebuchadnezzar, and we'll tell you what it means. And he says back in verse 5, the commandment from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn from limb and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. That's called negative motivation. If you guys don't explain to me what it is I dreamed, which of course that's the filter that will tell him if they know what they're talking about or not, because they don't know what he dreamed. So if they tell him an accurate description of that, he knows they're on the right trail. But if they don't do that, their houses will be rubbish heaps, and they will be torn limb from limb. It's a high-paying job, but it's also a high risk. If you don't come up with the right answer, they pull your arms off and things like that. On the other hand, a little positive motivation. If you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and rewards, a great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. So, dream number one. Okay, guys, tell me what it was. And you can just imagine these guys sweating profusely all of a sudden. They don't know what the heck he dreamed. There might be a little satanic help and involvement from time to time for these guys. I don't know. Maybe Satan gives them some insight to something here or there, and they look like they know what they're doing and that kind of thing. I don't know. But their job is to tell him both the dream and its interpretation. So they answer back to him a second time, and they said, well, let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare its interpretation. So once again, they appeal to him to tell them the dream. They can make something up for anything. And like doctors, they don't have to be right. You get a bill whether they're right or wrong. And they can be that way. They don't have to be right. They can come up with something. The king said, look, guys, I know for certain that you're bargaining for time, inasmuch as you've seen that the commandment from me is firm. You know I'm not going to tell you the dream. So you're just trying to prolong your life here. That if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. So their plan to tap dance for a while until he finally breaks down and tells them something isn't working. He repeats to them that they got to come up with the dream. This guy is no stoop. You don't get to be in this kind of a role in life and be a sucker for these wise men of Babylon. So the Chaldeans answered back and said, well, there's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult. Hey, this is hard, guy. And there's no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. Now, what they've said here in effect is, Nebuchadnezzar, you're a bum. Nobody would do this. Nobody could expect their people to interpret the dream without knowing anything about it. So you're just kind of like a mean old guy. How do you think he's going to respond? This is not the kind of guy that you insult. At least you best be running out the door while you're doing it if you're going to do it. This was not a real wise decision on their part. And because of that answer, verse 12, he became indignant and very furious. And he gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. This whole social structure, subset of wise men, there's four different specifics there mentioned earlier. He said, wipe them all out. You're all a bunch of charlatans. You're all a bunch of phonies. None of you know what you're talking about. Get rid of all of them, the whole category of everybody. Well, unfortunately, our boy Daniel is in that category. He is one of the wise men of Babylon. He's in that group that Nebuchadnezzar said, just wipe out. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them, trying to sweep up all of the wise men they got into a pile, and they're going to kill all of them. Now, Daniel could have gone underground, try to go hide, slip out of Babylon if he could or whatever, but he didn't. His response is, I think, reflective of the character we've seen in him so far. an impressive character. So Daniel replied with discretion and discernment. Again, we're talking about now he's maybe 20-ish, something like that. He was a young man when he went down there, and he's been there a few years, so he's not very old yet. Yet he's showing good discretion and discernment as a young man. Again, I'm very impressed with this guy. And he talks to the captain of the king's bodyguard, a guy named Arioch, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. Apparently he got the job. Peter makes a point in his epistles, done in 2 Peter 2:9, that God knows how to protect and to rescue the godly out of bad situations, Tony. He knows how to do that. He is skillful at protecting his own. Let's read that verse. That's probably one we ought to remind ourselves of from time to time. The Lord knows how, this is 2 Peter 2:9, the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptations or testings or difficulties and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. He can kind of filter us right through this bad situation, his children, protect us and care for us, and yet keep the others guilty in place for judgment. That's exactly what he does here. So he tells the bodyguard, go kill all these guys. And Daniel goes to him and say, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? So what's going on, Arioch? Why are you rounding up all the wise men? Something going on here? So Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king, notice he has access to Nebuchadnezzar himself, that he would give him some time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Now, so far, God hasn't told Daniel that he's going to give him the interpretation. Daniel knows that he's good at this sort of thing, perhaps maybe having already done a little bit of it before this incident takes place. But he doesn't have the assurance yet from God that this is going to happen. So when he told Nebuchadnezzar to give him a little time, he would then tell Nebuchadnezzar the dream and the interpretation. He obviously is confident that God is going to tell him what he needs to know here. He, I think, perceives that his role in being where he is, equipped with the skills that he has, is exactly for this sort of thing, and so he's confident that God is going to reveal this to him. So he goes in verse 17 and puts together in a rather hastily manner a prayer session with his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Those are their Jewish names. Remember, they got new names down in Babylon also. So he goes and grabs his buds, and they have this prayer session asking God that God would have compassion on them concerning this mystery, so Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So it's kind of a case of life and death for Daniel and his friends, and certainly for the other people as well. And so they asked that God would have compassion on them and, in essence, tell them what they need to know. And God did. Answered that prayer that night. Never a bad decision to put together a prayer meeting for something like this, is it? And a prayer is our best line of defense. And they knew that, and that's what they put to work. So that night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel, can you imagine trying to get to sleep under these circumstances? It would be probably past 10 o'clock for sure, wouldn't it? At any rate, he somehow or another gets to sleep, and God reveals to Daniel in a vision at night what this dream was. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Praising God for answered prayer is also always an appropriate thing to do. So these young men are doing the things they need to do to take care of business here. So God, so Daniel blesses God and cites several things in his praise. He says in verse 20, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It's kind of interesting to see these young men know this. They know wisdom and power belong to God. What do most young men today think about God, if they think about him at all? They don't think anything about him. They don't care about his word. He has spoken to us, given us about 800,000 words, and what do we do with it? We ignore all of it. We don't pay attention to it. But these men know this. And it is he who changes the times and the epochs. They know already the primary principle of this book, and that is that God controls the affairs of men. They know that. It's God who can change the time and the epochs. He removes kings and he establishes kings and he gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. So God works through those servants of his that he chooses to work through and gives them wisdom and knowledge and power and all the things they need to do the job for which he has planted them. He always equips us and enables us and then works through us to accomplish his will. It's he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for thou hast given me wisdom and power. Even now thou hast made known to me what we requested of thee, for thou hast made known to us the king's matter. So they're just trying to thank God as best they can for what he has done for them. He's given them the insight that they needed. They know what Nebuchadnezzar's dream was, and they also know the interpretation of it. So these four godly young men kind of picture in a typical fashion for us a proper response to God's answering of prayer. They're praising him and thanking him. So they got the answer they needed. So they're ready to go. So Daniel goes into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. I bet those guys didn't sleep well that night. He went and spoke to him as follows, "Don't destroy the wise men of Babylon." Now, there's a little insight into Daniel's character, isn't it? What does he care about these bums? They're charlatans, and they know it, and he knows it. Why does he intercede on their behalf? Because he's a
Later on, they're going to make his life hard, too.
That's true. I think he's probably just a great guy. A nice guy, a compassionate, kind guy. And so he appeals on behalf of these other guys to save their bacon. Wouldn't have to. Maybe he would think, well, if I get rid of all these other squirrels, I'll be the kingpin of this organization here. Let's just let them go. Forget them. Go and get rid of those guys. They're not going to do you any good. But he is quite merciful, quite compassionate toward them. And it seems to me, in keeping with the overall character we see of this guy, Daniel, says, and Daniel goes on to say, "Take me to the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king." So, a solution is at hand, a divinely instituted solution. So Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king." And Arioch said, hey king, I've got this problem solved for you here. I found this guy, and I brought him to you to solve the problem. Daniel approached Arioch, not the other way around. There's a little human nature on display for you there. Take credit for something somebody else does every time you get a chance. This guy does. So the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I've seen and its interpretation?" Remember, that's the whole objective here. You got to do both. This is a twofer. Nebuchadnezzar is going to get a twofer here, the dream and what it means. And Daniel answered before the king and said, "Well, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men nor conjurers, magicians nor diviners are able to declare it before the king." In other words, these guys can't do this, Nebuchadnezzar. However, there is a God in heaven who you may not know much about. I don't know what Nebuchadnezzar knew about the Hebrew God. Probably not much. So this may be all news to him. I don't know. There's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, that, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This dream has to do now with the end of a certain era. That era begins at 600 BC and goes down to the Second Advent, 2600 years and counting. This dream will make known to you, Nebuchadnezzar, what God is going to do in the next 2600 years, is what he said in effect. This was your dream and the visions of your mind while on your bed. Here's what you dreamed, Nebuchadnezzar. And all of this dream has to do with the next 2600 years of human history. As for you, O king, while on your bed and your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future, the latter days are future from Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar's time. Most of it's past from our time today, but it would all be future from theirs. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. I didn't understand this all on my own. It was God who revealed it to me, he tells Nebuchadnezzar. Here's what you saw. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. Vision number one in the book of Daniel involves a statue. That statue was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. So the whole thing starts to unfold around this awesome statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw. You know, it could have been other things, but it was a statue. And I'll show you in just a minute just what the statue looked like. But let's get a little more of it. The head of the statue was made of fine gold, its breasts and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, and legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So here's what he saw. Now, this may not be precisely what he saw, but it's kind of representative of it, okay? He saw this statue, and by the way, do you ever try to draw curved lines with a mouse, with a computer mouse? It ain't easy. It ain't easy to get back to the place where you started. At any rate, I had some software about 50 years ago, and I drew this punky thing with that, and I've just used that ever since. The main point of this statue is to note is that it's segmented four segments, four different segments, each of which is represented by a different metal. And as you notice, as you come down from head to toe, the metal or the composition of the thing becomes cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. The top of it was the best part. It was gold. And then the torso is at least silver. That's still pretty good stuff. Then the thigh is bronze, and the waist down is a combination of iron and clay mixed together. Four-segmented statue. Dream number one, made of four different kinds of metals that decrease in value as you go from top to bottom. All right? If I saw an awesome statue like that one, I'd be up all night worried about it too, just like Nebuchadnezzar was. And you continued looking, Daniel goes on to say in verse 34, until a stone was cut out without hands. Here comes this big stone that was not hewn by human hands. And it struck the statue on the feet of iron and clay and crushed them. So So the stone in the vision comes whirling in and smashes it right here and crushes all of that bottom part of that statue. And in it you saw that the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. The bottom portion of this statue is not very homogeneous. It's heterogeneous. It's a mixture of things that don't stick together well. Okay? And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will in itself endure forever. So during the days that this stone comes in and crushes this thing on its bottom here, God sets up a kingdom that will never end. God steps into the picture. He sets up his kingdom to do some things. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, and the silver, and the gold, that great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. So far, what Nebuchadnezzar knows is that this statue, four-segmented statue, will be crushed by a stone that doesn't have human origin, and the whole thing just falls apart. And the God of heaven is stepping into this picture and taking care of things.
I think you might have skipped ahead a little bit.
What's that?
Because Daniel didn't tell, so far Daniel hasn't told Nebuchadnezzar that he's the gold head.
Yes, right. He hasn't given him the interpretation yet. Oh, I beg your pardon. I jumped too far down. Yeah, he does. He starts that in verse 36. So he's going to get to interpretation next, yes. He's got to know what's going to happen here. I jumped too far. Okay, let's go back up to verse 36 and get to interpretation. This was the dream. Now we shall tell its interpretation before you, O king. So the statue and its how it's depicted, and the great mountain stone smashing it, all that stuff, that's part of the dream. Now, here's the interpretation. Verse 37. You, O king, are the king of kings to whom God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. So the first segment of this statue here is Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom of Babylon. Okay? He's the top of this thing. This is a kingdom. This is the Babylonian kingdom. This is Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom up here at the top. And he must be the best leader of all of these different guys, all these different kingdoms, because he's the gold. So you, Nebuchadnezzar, are numero uno of the statue. But notice how many times he points out to him that God has given him this stuff. The God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. He doesn't learn this lesson well. He doesn't learn that God is in control of the affairs of men and that God has given him his position and power and all of that stuff. He has to learn it the hard way in chapter 4. But going on with the interpretation, after you there will be arise another kingdom inferior to you. Then a third kingdom over bronze will rule over all the earth. So there are kingdoms following kingdoms here, and the different values of the metals and so on is indicating that this next kingdom is not going to be quite as good as the Babylonian kingdom. Then there will come another kingdom after this one, and it won't be as good as the previous one. So we're seeing a succession of Gentile world powers following each other in history and kind of declining in overall value or rule, not necessarily weaker in terms of the amount of territory they conquer or that sort of thing, but they're not as good as the previous one. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. So the fourth kingdom down here will be the strongest of them, not necessarily the most valuable, well-run kingdom, but the strongest of them, and iron is able to pound all of these other metals into some shape or form if you wanted to use them. If to reshape things, you could. And in it you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. It will be a divided kingdom. It'll have the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. So the fourth kingdom is actually stronger than any of the previous three. The toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. The kingdom represented by this fourth segment down here will have the qualities of being both strong and yet easy to fracture. It'll be brittle. It can be broken apart. So unlike the previous ones, it is a mixture of stuff. It's got a not permanent construction to it. In it you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. So that last kingdom down there will not be a real good strong unit. It will be fractured. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. So inasmuch as you saw that a stone cut out of the mountain without hands, and it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future, so the dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. So at some point in time, during the existence of this mixture of a kingdom here at the bottom of the statue, God will come into the scene and crush all of these Gentile world empires and set up his own kingdom that will never fail. So what in the heck have we seen in this first dream? Well, we've seen that history going forward from Nebuchadnezzar's day, from roughly 600 B.C., until the time that God comes back and enters into this picture, there will be four major Gentile world powers represented by those segments. And as you can see, they kind of decline in value and purpose and so on, until the last one, which is the most interesting of all of them, it will be in existence when God comes back, when God sets up his own kingdom here on earth. So one of these Gentile world empires isn't historic to even us today. These were, but not this one, because God will crush this one, and he hasn't done that yet. So we're still waiting for this, and we're going to get more information about it. This is not all we get about this particular segment of the statue. And we'll actually be able to, we got them up there already identified on the chart, but we'll be able to identify them as we go forward. First kingdom is the Babylonian Empire. The second one is the Medo-Persian Empire. Third one will be Greece. And the fourth one is the Roman Empire. And this mixture that will be in existence when God comes back, that's going to be the most interesting one of all. That's the revived Roman Empire. We'll get information about that as we go. So from 600 B.C. down to the second advent, the world is going to see the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, and a revitalization of that into the revived Roman Empire. That fourth one is the most interesting one of all, and it's the one that the conclusion of which we haven't seen yet. Us today, we haven't seen it yet. Now, this may seem to us like old stuff. Who cares? Who cares about the Babylonian Empire and the Medo-Persian and the Greek empires and the original Roman Empire? They're all dead and gone. Well, it wasn't dead and gone to Nebuchadnezzar. It was all still future. Most of it's dead and gone for us today, but even not all that. The bottom part of the last segment is still TBD. It hasn't occurred yet. Beg your pardon?
Medo-Persian.
The Medes and the Persians. The Medes had an empire, and the Persians had an empire, and they said, hey, let's get together and have us a really big empire. So that's what they did. So Medo-Persian Empire are the Medes and the Persians. Yeah, thanks, Janet. I think the Medes were more in this area and the Persians over here into Iran, and they combined into this pink, generally pink area that you see here, okay? And the Babylonian Empire was taken over by them, so they kind of just took over all of this then later on. So they're sort of a combination empire, Medes and Persians. The Iranians are the Persians, or what's left of them. The Iraqis would be the Babylonians, and what's left of them. And the Greeks just swept through all of that. Alexander conquered all of that territory by the time he was like 33. His father, Philip, was an outstanding military man, and he apparently learned everything from him, and he was a fantastic warrior and conqueror. He got sick and died at the age of 33.
Alexander did?
Yeah.
And his dad was Philip of Macedon,
right? Yeah, Philip of Macedon was his father. Philippi was built by him for, I believe, a woman. I think he built that for Alexander's sister or somebody. Like, I forget some of this stuff. Anyway, he was rather fantastic. And his descendants were fighting things out when the Romans came on the scene. And they kind of jumped in the middle of stuff and started shutting down the remnants of the Greek Empire. He divided it into four pieces when Alexander died. He had four generals, and these guys got one of it, and some of it got into here, and I think some more of it got over here, and some of it up here maybe. I can show you something that has that on it if anybody ever cared, but at any rate, all of that got absorbed by the Romans anyway. And the Romans started ruling the roost from about, I don't know, 50 B.C. to about 450 A.D., and all of those four military alliances and so on shown by that statue came to pass, and then all of a sudden it looked like that the Romans went to sleep. They kind of left off the world scene, it seemed. The Huns and the Goths and all these different European types start pecking away at the fringes of the Roman Empire and brought it down to essentially a nothing. I think they consider the end of the Roman Empire to be about 457 or 451 along and through there, something like that. But it didn't actually die off. It came back, or it will come back. It hasn't came back, it will come back. and we might see some of that taking place. Well, let's look at the last few verses here of Daniel. At verse 46, after getting this definition from Daniel, both of the dream and the interpretation, the king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel. That's kind of what you call arriving, when the king is falling down at your feet. And he gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense, gave him a bottle of stinkum. I was kind of expecting a little more, you know, for Daniel. But he'll get a little more here. So the king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." So then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. So this guy's like VP of Babylon, in charge of everything. And he made requests of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. So he intervenes on behalf of his friends, and they're given promotions and outstanding leadership roles in the kingdom of Babylon. So much of that now, much of Babylon is ran by Daniel and his three friends. Not bad for a, what would we say, 20-year-old guy, something like that, maybe?
Well, it's like Joseph being second
only. Yeah, power. Yeah, very similar. So vision number one, a statue segmented into four different parts. Each one will represent a world Gentile kingdom that will dominate Israel. And for the next 2,600 years, they don't know how to put a timeline on it, probably like we do. We know when that stone cut without hands comes back and crushes that, that'll be the second advent. We don't know when that will be even ourselves, but we know it's still in the future. So they don't know it's 2,600 years. We know that now, but they just know it's the future. They don't know how long the future is going to be. But that's the basic structure now of this vision. The other visions that we will see will just delineate in more detail what chapter 2 just did. Won't be a different vision. The structure can't be different. The 2,600 years is going to happen as it was shown in chapter 2. So it ain't going to be a different structure, but it's going to have more meat hung on it. We'll understand a little more detail about it. And by the time we are through with this book, we'll understand a lot of detail about how it's going to take place. We'll even get an example of the guy who's going to head up and lead the last empire, the revised Roman Empire that's going to come back into play. We'll get an example of a guy who will look like and act just like that guy. So we get a sneak preview. His name will be Antiochus Epiphanes. He's a Syrian king, and we'll see how he comes on the scene. He's actually one of Alexander's leftovers, and he will exhibit the same basic characteristics of what we call the Antichrist, the final world ruler. We'll see him in chapter 11. We'll see a lot of detail about him there. So what we're going to do as we go forward is just hang more and more meat on this structure we just saw here in chapter 2. Chapter 2 is kind of the backbone, and there's more to come. Somewhere I got a... Yeah, I got it. We'll get into it later, and I'll show you how it all just... We just kind of keep relayering chapter 2 with more and more information.
Oh, so this was all good news for Nebuchadnezzar.
Beg your pardon?
This was all good news for Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, oh, he's happy to hear it. He's got somebody that will...
He's great, but he's also already got it. He doesn't have to go out and get it. It's already right there for him.
Yeah. Chapter 2 unveils these Gentile world empires. This one we got to get a little more information about later on. And in chapter 7 and 8, just go back over the same structure and gives us more detail as to who these guys are and what they're doing. So it's all the same picture from 600 BC to the Second Advent. It's all chapter 2, just layered with more and more information. So the whole book is going to now fill in information that we just saw skeletonized for us in chapter 2. You with me? And by the time we get down to, well, really through chapter 11, we'll know a lot about all of these guys. So that's why I say this panorama of future history, future history, that's right, is the most detailed, most thorough, most inclusive of any we have anywhere. Now, the book of Revelation gives us a lot more detail about a particular period of time, 7 years of this. But this is 2,600 years of history, Jew and Gentile. So that's why the book of Daniel is so inclusive and so impressive in what it teaches us.
And this is also referred to as the times of the Gentiles, right?
Yes. It's the time period where the Gentile nations dominate and rule over Israel, which was at the end of the destruction of the Judean kingdom by Nebuchadnezzar. That's the end of the Gentiles' kingdoms, end of the Jewish kingdoms, and then the Gentiles will rule over them until the Second Advent. Then they will rule over everybody else during the millennial kingdom. Any questions about any of this before we hit the road? To give anybody a headache trying to mass and holding on this? Okay. We'll let you roll and see you next Sunday, Lord willing.
So, do you think you should try leaving your furniture there and see if it works?
Well, the class ahead of us will probably move it.
They might like it.
I don't know whether to take that chance or not.
They might not even know that.
I don't know what's going on yet enough. They may move. I better stick with my little corner because they may move somebody in here. The teacher may show up. I don't know why she hasn't shown up yet, because the school, I think, has started. Yeah, there you go. We used to always have a rule at work. If somebody had an absentee problem on Monday, they probably had an alcohol.